Case number 13-5057, Richard E. LeBeau et al. Appellants versus United States Department of State et al. Mr. Shurker for the appellants, Mr. Birch for the appellees.
May it please the court, Elliot Shurker on behalf of the appellants. There are two issues presented to this court on APA review. First, can the department's construction of 5 U.S.C. section 5547 as requiring retroactive forfeiture paid out overtime pass Chevron muster? And second, is the department's refusal to consider plaintiffs' waiver requests, which were denied by placing the onus on the plaintiffs for the department's admitted and repeated failures, supported by a reasoned explanation. Turning to section 5547, which governs premium pay, including overtime, and is generally capped on a biweekly basis. In an emergency or mission critical work, such as plaintiffs were performing in Iraq in 2004, it's capped on a yearly basis. Quote, the aggregate of the basic pay and premium pay for on a yearly basis may not, quote, exceed the greater of two GS salary caps as, quote, in effect at the end of such calendar year.
Can I ask a question just to put this argument in context? So as I understand this argument, what you are suggesting is that all you could get, your clients could get back, is whatever comes from the difference between two caps, 128 and 130. So this argument wouldn't allow them to get back everything. The waiver argument is different, but with respect to this argument, it would only allow, at most, getting back the difference between the 128 cap and the 130 cap.
The answer to that, Your Honor, is yes, but the second piece of the argument is the $200,000 retroactive cap.
Yeah, so if I take your point. So $200,000 brings it in the same camp as waiver.
Correct.
But on this part of it, just if you just look at this statute without taking into account what happened with the 2005, the law that refers to 2005, then what we're talking about is the potential difference between 128 and 130.
Again, with a yes, but as to Mr. Landis, who owed $400-some-odd.
I'm sorry?
Mr. Landis owed $400-some-odd. Because he was very junior in grade,
right? So
he would win completely on this issue. Everybody else, I have won something else.
All I'm saying is the maximum somebody could get is the difference between 128 and 130.
That's correct.
Now, as to that, for these individuals to bring a case that seeks the difference between 128 and 130, that difference has to matter to them. And as I understand your argument, the way that this calculation should have occurred is that for the periods in time in which they were earning money but getting the locality adjustment for D.C., that period of time should be subject to the 130 cap. Other periods of time should be subject to the 128 cap.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's correct. Okay, that's correct. And then it seems to me that they can only recover anything if they get past 128 in the periods of time that they were subject to the 130 cap. Because otherwise, the difference between 128 and 130 just doesn't make a difference to them, right?
Well, there's a total number. What state did, I understand the question, but what state did was to compute a total number of overpayment. And under the 130 cap, for the period of time between February and July, before the embassy opened, they would be entitled to some of that money back.
Right, so, and my question is, between February and July, did anybody get past 128? Because if they didn't, the difference between a 128 and a 130 cap doesn't matter.
I don't know if anyone's ever done the math, certainly not in the administrative proceedings, because the question never arose since we lost at the doorstep.
So we went back and looked at to the extent to which we can get indicia from the record. And if you look at the decision that was made by Millett, if I remember the name correctly, that analysis for each person identifies a pay period, which is the pay period at which they exceeded the lower cap. And all those pay periods were something like pay period 23, 22, pretty far out in the year, past July. And if that's true, then is there any standing to bring a claim as between 128 and 130 if they never got past 128 at a period in time at which the 130 cap was in effect?
And that's a fair question. But the answer to that question I think, can best be found, and I'll cite the court, the joint appendix of 1479 and then 211 through about 220. The only actual pay records that answer those questions, that address when overtime was paid for any of these folks, are Mr. Boff's records. Those are the only ones that are in the administrative record. But what those records show at JA 1479 is that the total overpayment to Mr. Boff is $5,786.60. If you go to Mr. Boff's actual pay records, and I'm now at JA 219, you see that as of June of 2004, Mr. Boff, on his year-to-date overtime, had been paid $3,309. So he had been paid already in June, before the lower cap went into effect, $3,000 in overtime.
I'm not understanding why the overtime alone matters, because I thought what matters is if the total compensation exceeds the 128 cap.
The states told us what the number is, though. States told us the total number is $5,780. That's the number he has to pay back. Mm-hmm. That's the overpayment.
Right.
He'd been paid $3,000 as of June. He had no overtime left as of June. Now, the reason that happens, and I think that the confusion about period 23, period 24, et cetera, is that because these folks are law enforcement officers, they're required under LEAP to work 400 hours of overtime a year, and they're paid for 400 hours of overtime a year, but they're not paid all at once, and they're not paid as they work that overtime. It's trickled into their paychecks on a regular basis. So they're being paid for overtime throughout the year before they work it, essentially. The idea is that law enforcement officers are always going to have to work overtime. So there's 400 hours built in. And, of course, there's 400 hours built in for these folks, means that once the cap got lowered, the boom was down, was lowered on.
Is the 400 hours that's built in, that's premium pay?
That's premium pay, yes, sir. But it's trickled into their paychecks. So it's computed as overtime pay, even if they may not have worked those hours. So by the time they get to the end of the year, they've worked all the hours.
So I guess I'm still not understanding why what you've identified shows us that the combination of premium pay and basic pay exceeded 128 before the individual you're referring to was treated as being in Iraq.
And reading government pay records is not a rewarding experience, and I apologize if I'm not being clear. There are more elements of pay on these folks' records than I could even imagine existed. So here's the way I get there, math not being my strongest point. The annual, it says on page 1479 of the record from Mr. Bob, annual premium pay cap, 128,200. That's the 128 cap that's being applied to him at the end of the year.
I'm sorry, are you talking about
1479?
Of the joint appendix?
Yes, sir.
1479 of the joint appendix.
This is FSGB.
I'm sorry, I may have the wrong side. I may have the wrong side.
Okay.
These would be Mr. Bob's pay records. 1424. I apologize. I'd written down 1479.
That's certification page.
This is the sheet that I'm referring to. It's page 48 of the administrative record in Mr. Boff's case. This is the sheet I'm referring to, and I will find the page.
Okay.
To give it to the court.
What does it say? Is it?
It's document number 29-2 in the district court, page 51. 29-2 in the district court,
okay,
page 51.
1428 in the joint appendix.
My apologies, Your Honor.
That's all right. Now, what's his total pay on that?
It says total pay that he received is 133,986.
He's already been paid that much.
That's what he was paid, and that's why he has to pay back $5,700.
No. I think that the question Judge Srinivasan is asking is, you were talking about something in June, right?
Yes, and that is page 219.
Okay, hold on 1 second. 219.
Yes, sir. That's this page.
219 of?
The joint appendix. That's this page right here.
What was his total pay as of that day? Total pay, not his annual salary, but what was his year-to-date? His year-to-date total earnings was around $58,000, correct?
Well, that's the regular pay.
Well, what's the total pay?
There's no number on here that gives us that.
Well, you can add it up, though.
It looks like it's about, not as fast as I would like, Your Honor. It's about $75,000.
Right. So it's under $128,000.
Correct, because it was midway through the year.
I understand. So maybe we're both asking the same question, which is, what is your theory about how much somebody, what is the cap for somebody who works 6 months, say, under the higher rate and 6 months under the lower rate? What is the theory about what the cap is at the end of the first 6 months?
The theory is that you compute out the overtime against the cap, and because in June, when the numbers changed, everything that had been paid to him was coming to him, and more could have been coming to him under the cap. You don't retroactively apply the lower cap, so that when he got his paycheck in June, if the 120, let me try it a different way. The $128,000 cap applied retroactively. When he got that June paycheck, he was done. He could not work any more overtime.
When did the you talk about retroactivity, when did that cap come into existence?
Our position, Your Honor, is it never did, but it was
in there in the law.
The statute's been there 17 years.
17 years. I don't see how this is called retroactive.
It's not a retroactive application of the statute, because the statute doesn't say retroactive. Mm-hmm. The statute says in effect at the end of the year.
At the end of the year.
It's a placeholder that Congress puts there, and it doesn't say if your assignment changes during the year. Obviously, if Congress were to change.
So it doesn't seem to me that the statute intended to make any difference based on it, since it doesn't say that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The statute just says in effect at the end of the year. So I don't see either the retroactivity or the ambiguity that you reference.
It's not the statute. It's the OPM. Because it's OPM that told us in September of 2004 for the first time, told the plaintiffs and everybody else in the world, that the statute was going to be applied retroactively based on location. That had never been said before. That's what I mean by retroactive.
I don't really understand the retroactivity you're talking about.
Because it sweeps back to the whole year.
But the statute seems, by its very language, to sweep back for the whole year.
The statute says
it applies what's in effect at the end of the year.
But the statute
apply it for the whole
correct,
year.
Correct, right. But it doesn't say look backwards and change it. It doesn't say based on your location. It doesn't say based on your particular job.
There's thousands of things it doesn't say. But what it does say is in effect at the end of the year, which would seem to mean what it says. That's what governs.
That's correct. That's what governs as they're being paid. So when they're being paid.
So on the when they're being paid rationale, okay, let me just see if I can at least get an agreement on this, which is that your theory is that the cap that should apply to their premium pay is the one in effect at the time that they're being paid.
That's correct.
So is it a correct statement to say, unless somebody has exceeded 128 at the time that they're switched over to the lower cap site, they don't have standing to bring a claim along the lines of what you're saying?
Judge, I would disagree.
How can that be? Because
part of the reason I feel comfortable disagreeing, if I might, of course, is that the government's never raised this issue before as to our standing to make this case. So
which we have to look at anyway.
Of course, yeah. And I'm happy to talk about it. But I take some comfort with everything else that's been thrown at us that the government hasn't made that argument as well. The way I answer your question, I still go back to that to Mr. Boff's records, because what state is supposed to do, what all agencies are supposed to do, and of course the state didn't do that here, even though they repeatedly said they would, but that goes to the waiver issue, is under the regulations, compute your overtime out ahead of time. They're supposed to take the number that you're entitled to and compute it out ahead of time. And part of the reason they're supposed to do that, of course, is so you don't get overpaid. Part of the reason they said they were going to do that for these plaintiffs was so that they could roll over other aspects of their pay. There are some elements that can be rolled into the next year and some that can't. Premium pay can't be rolled into the next year. So the idea would be, for example, that they would pay out the premium pay up front and then roll the other elements over so no one ended up owing the department money, as they ultimately conceded they didn't have any mechanism for doing that. But that's the reason why the number in the middle of the year matters, because the calculation of the overtime to which you're entitled is being made on a monthly basis, even though it's capped on a yearly basis.
Your theory, if I understand it, is as long as they have not exceeded $128,000 during the period in which they had the higher cap, they had the lower, higher cap, I'm sorry, $130,000 during that period, they get to keep whatever they earn during that period. And then if the new, is that right?
Yes, sir.
As long as by June they have not exceeded the higher cap, they should be allowed to keep the money up to that. And then starting from then on, any additional amount, what's your theory about the meaning of the statute with respect to their after that?
Then the $128,000 cap applies.
And it applies to just new money earned from then on?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's your standing argument. That we, if we accept your theory of the statute, then you get to keep the money. That's your stand. Now, how do you get that interpretation of the statute out of the statute? I mean, where do you get from the statute that you get to keep an amount up to a cap midway through the year? What words in the statute give you that? And let me just call your attention to the fact that there is a section of the statute that would have given you that protection, which is A, because it was computed by pay period. But that doesn't apply. The statute goes to B.
Correct.
So you're asking not for a pay period rule, but for a part of the year rule. And where do you get that in the words of the statute?
I don't get it from any specific language in the statute. Okay. Our argument is very simple. The state has never given us a reason. OPM, state, nobody ever explained why it is that they applied it retroactively.
Well, they're, assume their theory is it's the words. I want to know what words of the statute. So assume we don't give them any deference. We just have to make the best interpretation of the statute between two alternatives, the one given by state and you. Where do you derive your – I appreciate you have a fairness argument, but that's not where we start. We start with the words. What words of the statute suggest that we should look the first 6 months of the year or something like that?
Because it's the words that the statute, Your Honor, doesn't say. The words that it says the pay shall not be, no employee referred to in such paragraph may be paid premium pay under subsection A, or to the extent the aggregate of the basic pay and premium pay would in any calendar year exceed the greater of one of those two numbers. So the question is, what does it mean in effect at the what does in effect at the end of the year mean?
Yeah.
And we say it means you're being paid on a week. Congress knows that employees are not paid at the end of the year. They're paid during the year. And Congress also is presumed to know that calculations are made on a biweekly basis,
That's what A was for. That was it. If you were under A, you'd have a great case, but A doesn't apply. That is all that you're saying all applies to A, not to B.
So, but Your Honor, the point is that A shows that Congress knows that individuals are paid on a biweekly basis.
Right.
And knowing that, they use that language in effect at the end of the year.
Because they have.
And what I did not hear in what you just said is some definition of those words that support your position here.
The best explanation of those words is the explanation.
Let's explain them. Let's define them. Let's try to figure out what Congress could mean by those words other than in effect at the end of the year, other than governing at the end of the year.
We adopted throughout the position taken by the American Foreign Services Association in this case, which urged the State Department to construe those words as meaning, as you're paying individuals, you're doing it in reference to the pay cap in effect at the end of the year. If Congress were to change that pay cap during the year, that would be the pay cap in effect at the end of the year, but that the statute doesn't contemplate rolling changes.
So I thought your argument was that in effect at the end of the year, what that tells you is that let's just round the figures and say these people were subject to two different rates as those appeared at the end of the year. One was GS-15 rates. Leave aside B about level 5 of the executive schedule. On A, for maximum rate of pay for GS-15, there was a 130 rate, which is when they were treated as being in D.C., and then there was a 113 rate or something like that.
That's correct.
113.
The locality pay, it went up.
Those were the two rates in effect at the end of the year. I thought your argument was that gives effect to in effect at the end of the year because it tells you what the GS-15 was at the end of the year, but it doesn't tell you which one of those governs with respect to the collection of the pay. And so you have to do something else tells you which one of those governs. So your argument is not that the statute actually compels a reading in your favor. It's that it at least permits it, and then somebody has to do the work to figure out which reading of the statute is the best.
That's a very fair characterization of our argument and a much more elegant way of putting it than I've been able to say thus far. What we're saying is, and Judge Garland, this gets to your comment, look no further than Judge Bates' order. Judge Bates essentially said that I recognize that this statute, as applied by the government, would mean that if one of these folks had been working in D.C. through December 28th and was transferred to Iraq on December 28th, having earned all overtime under the higher cap in D.C. for that entire period of time, on the day of his or her transfer to Iraq would retroactively lose the $2,000 differential.
So isn't that what the waiver's for? That's why the statute provides a waiver as a way to get out of any unfairness that might be caused.
And Judge, we're perfectly happy to talk about it in terms of waiver.
But in other words, yes, the statute could be unfair, so Congress provides a waiver, but that doesn't mean we don't begin with the way the statute requires it and then move to the waiver. So that would put all of your eggs in the waiver basket.
If I might do a yes-but answer again, please.
Of course.
The OPM, Federal Register, announcement of the new regulations in September 2004 the statute says this, and whether it does or not, we've been talking about for some time. But OPM also announced regulations, because one agency said, this doesn't seem fair to us. One agency commented on the proposed rule, saying this doesn't seem fair to us that if someone's pay changes based on their location, there's nothing we can do about this. And OPM essentially said, no, don't worry about that, because we're promulgating these new regulations that tell you this very complicated way of figuring the overtime out ahead so no one gets penalized. So when OPM said that this is how we're going to apply the statute, this isn't just waiver, Judge Garland. They said we're building in a mechanism that will prevent the unfairness that you're worried about, agency.
Your position in your reply brief is that the plaintiffs realistically had no option about performing the overtime, right?
That's what the FSGB said, and that is our position. Yes, sir.
Okay. So if that's the case, there's nothing your plaintiffs could have done, or that Department of State or OPM could have done, to beat this problem, right? They have to, because they're in Iraq and they're protecting the embassy, they have to do overtime whether it exceeds the cap or not.
That's correct.
And so there is no way for, I guess now I'm moving to the waiver question, which is, why does notice matter? To your clients, there's nothing they could have done to change what they were doing. They couldn't say, look, I'm about to hit the cap, so I'm not going to put in for overtime. They had to do the overtime. So I don't understand why notice for your clients matters, one way or the other.
We don't think notice matters.
You argued that you weren't told until very late in the year. In other words, it seems like you're making two different arguments. One of your arguments is it's not fair. You weren't told until late in the year. They didn't have a method of protecting your overtime. But on the other hand, you're pointing out there really is no method. No notice would have helped you. No method would have helped you, because you've got to do the overtime whether you exceed the cap or not.
And, Judge, just as a parenthetical, if you look at the record, of course, my clients performed countless unpaid hours voluntarily while in Iraq.
This is
part of the answer, Your Honor, because they were going to do whatever they had to do to perform the mission, and they were commended for doing that. So this isn't about refusing to do work.
No, quite the opposite. I get that. I'm taking your position, and I think rightly, that they really did not have an option. But if they didn't have an option, then there's really nothing that could have been done to protect them anyway.
That may be the best waiver argument.
But that's not
that I could make.
But it's not an argument about notice or anything else. It's inherent in the nature of law enforcement.
It's inherent in the nature of the way the government treated people who worked in Iraq in 2004. Is what it is.
How does that make notice matter? If they had notice or didn't have notice, wouldn't they have still had to do the same work either way? Now that's a yes or no. You might put a but after it, but give me a yes or no on it first.
The answer is yes.
Okay.
And they would have. So it's almost a moot question.
Well, I suppose
notice matters because I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to suggest a way in which notice might have mattered, but I don't want to stop you from suggesting it.
I'll do my best. Notice matters because, everything else aside, whether they were going to perform unpaid work or not, there's a difference between performing unpaid work, as most lawyers know, for which you know you're not going to get paid, and performing unpaid work retroactively and not being paid when you thought you were going to be paid. And for these folks, It's not being paid after they were paid.
But I guess the question is, how does that hurt them? And to me, it seems like notice could, in theory, matter because there's a question here about knowing whether you have money that's yours to keep or money that's not yours to keep that you have to give back. And you could imagine a situation in which the lack of notice means that you get money and then you start making all sorts of spending decisions based on the assumption that you're going to keep the money.
Correct.
That might be a notice argument that would work, but that can't work in this case because there was no introduction of evidence, as I understand it, on the waiver question about a reliance interest of that variety to the effect that these individuals got money. It turns out they had to give the money back, but they made a bunch of decisions in the interim that were predicated on the assumption, turns out to be false, that they could keep the money.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was trying to say. People get paid. Government workers get paid. They spend the money on their families and supporting their families.
But it seems like the problem with that is that I thought that in this case there was no evidence introduced that there was any kind of reliance interest along those lines. In fact, I thought that the district court said this, and I think the agency did too, that there's a number of factors that the waiver regulation takes into account. There's unconscionability. There's the timing difference between when the payment occurred and when notice occurred. And then there's a couple that go to reliance interest and expenditures that might have been made. And I thought what happened was that, although given the invitation to submit evidence as to the reliance factor, no evidence was submitted on that.
Judge, I apologize. We rested on the record that we'd already made, and that record is before you. And that record is replete with state telling my clients, and they're all quoted in the brief, and I can read them here this morning, that we will watch your backs. The onus is not on you to compute.
So I guess I'm trying to say something.
That's the reliance, is we relied on state to do what they said they were going to do.
No, I'm saying something a little bit different. Let's imagine a situation in which what the people who receive the money does is the following. They say, I just got $5,000 of overtime pay. I understand that this $5,000 actually is in some jeopardy. I'm not sure yet whether I'm going to get to keep it. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to put it aside, understanding that I'm not going to make life-changing decisions based on that $5,000 because I may never get to keep it. That's different for someone who says, I got $5,000. Every indication that I have right now is that this is my money. I'm going to go spend it on some stuff. And then later on, it turns out, I actually got to fork over $5,000 that I don't have anymore. And I guess as I understand the state of the record, that kind of evidence could have been introduced if it were true. But there wasn't that kind of evidence introduced that went to that factor on the waiver regulation. And so we're left with a record under which we can't take account of that kind of notice argument because the evidence just isn't in the record.
Judge, it's in the FSGB's first decision that the first notice that my clients received was in November of 2004. That notice the FSGB called vague, of no assistance to the clients in deciding what to do. And the reason they said that was
because... But what decisions were made in detrimental... Even if we agree with you, what decisions were made by the employees in detrimental reliance on the lack of notice? That's what seems to be missing. I'm not saying that that couldn't have happened. I'm not saying that there's not a colorable argument of unfairness here. What I'm saying is I don't believe we have evidence in the record that says here's the decisions I made in detrimental reliance on the assumption that I get to keep this money.
Because before November 2004, they were paid, and I don't think it's unfair to presume that they, since no one had told them that they might have to give it back, that they spent it in support of their families.
So your reliance is on a presumption that they spent the money. That's all you have to offer us on that is a presumption. There is no evidence that they actually acted in reliance on state.
Judge, I don't think when no one's told you that you have to give it back, it's unreasonable to presume that government workers spend their paychecks.
That's what we're trying to get to, though, is all you're relying on that is a presumption.
Yes, sir. No one's ever questioned.
Nobody ever offered any evidence made a spending decision based on that assumption.
The only other point I'd like to make
before you go on. So I think what we're all discussing here is JA 897 to 898, which is the Foreign Service Grievance Board's decision in 2010.
The second decision.
That's right. And it lists the five factors for waiver. The second of which is whether, because of the erroneous payment, the employee either has relinquished a valuable right or changed positions for the worse, regardless of the employee's financial circumstances. And then the next paragraph says the department sought additional information from grievance concerning how these factors applied to them before reaching the decision on the merits. It says, in providing the input, the grievance attorney has relied on arguments already in the record that was unfair and inequitable. They provided no information with respect to financial hardship, nor did they specifically comment on the other factors outlined in the regulations.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's that's an accurate description of what happened.
That is what happened. We relied on the unconscionability of having these plaintiffs, unlike everyone who served in Iraq starting in January 2005, have to pay back paid out overtime when they first got notice that that might be a problem in November. And that notice, if I might, Your Honor, that notice was a form email. And that's what I was turning to. That notice was a form email that told the plaintiffs in November 24th, 2004, that state is currently conducting a review of premium pay earnings. This is the JA-179, involving employees supporting the effort in Iraq. During our review, we have determined that your earnings applicable toward the 2004 annual premium pay cap have already or will shortly put you above the cap for the current pay year. We will contact you with additional details concerning your specific situation as we finalize our review of the overtime payments. That was in November of 2004. And when Mr. Bopp inquired, what should I be doing in response to this, the response is JA-181. The onus is not and should not be on the employee. It was a change in payroll processing that led to this problem, and the government's working hard to develop means of preventing a recurrence. That's the sum total of the notice received in November, and we know from the interrogatory responses during the administrative challenges that state was aware as early as August of 2004 that there might have been overpayments. And in August of 2004 was when state issued a memorandum saying everybody should continue to work all necessary overtime and we will protect your overtime rights by projecting the money out. And it wasn't until the state responded to Senator Warner's inquiry and on behalf of Mr. Lubow and said we did not have any mechanism in place for doing this. So to the extent that notice is important. Notice is important because we're balancing.
Notice is not though what we've been trying to infer, but it's reliance. Those are two different things.
I understand.
You have notice, you have reliance. Notice, you've got a little bit of argument on it. Reliance, you're relying on a presumption, maybe that's enough. But that's what you have, right?
No one in these proceedings has raised a question as to whether my clients would have spent the money in the ordinary course of their lives. If they had reason to believe in August that they were not going to be able, and actually the irony here, Your Honors, is they talk about the retroactive application of the 2005 waiver, the $200,000 cap. The real irony here is when that went into effect in December, we say it would have been effective in December. November 24th is the first time the government tells my clients that they might be exceeding or might have exceeded the pay cap. If they didn't work, the reason we didn't get the 2005 waiver applied to us, according to state, on remand from the district court, was because they didn't work any overtime hours in December of 2004. That was right after they'd been noticed, put on notice that they might be exceeding the cap.
Ask a factual question. I take it none of the plaintiffs were ever actually in Washington. That was never where they actually worked, right?
Oh, no, they did.
They did?
They did, yes, sir.
I thought they were on TDY Washington.
No, they were on TDY in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Because they were based in Washington. They all volunteered for service. State sent a cable out saying, They were physically in Iraq as of February. They came at some different dates, but they were all physically in Iraq as of February or March.
But they came from
D.C.
So in January.
I thought somebody came from Houston. There's a reference to Houston.
I think Mr. Landis may have come from Houston. Uh-huh.
So some of them in January were in Washington. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, some. They went at different times between January and March.
And when they went to Iraq, they were on TDY from Washington for a while and then just in Iraq.
They were on TDY until the embassy opened, and then there was a keystroke and their status changed. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that I probably used my allotted time.
You used everybody's allotted time.
And I will ask for the court's indulgence for a few minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, Alan Birch on behalf of the Department of State. I want to address, of course, the statutory question and the waiver question. I'd like to start with Judge Srinivasan's line of questions about the statute and the sort of what I would call a prorating methodology of applying it. There is no such prorating methodology. It's either the biweekly or the annual. The annual, to be absolutely certain as to what the annual rate is, you need to know where the employee is stationed at year end. And then you go back and you calculate what that cap would have meant to make sure that the pay was done correctly.
Why? Are you suggesting that Congress could not have written a statute to work in the way that
the statute that Congress wrote provides for one of those two mechanisms. The normal
a
mechanism is
by pay period, and B would be by annual.
Exactly. And so
I don't understand that, because what it says is, I'm not saying that you don't have the better understanding. I don't mean to suggest one way or the other. What I'm asking is whether their argument can be fit within the terms of the statute. And maybe it can't, but I'm not understanding from what you just said why it can't, for the following reason. Under 2A, it says the maximum rate of basic pay payable for GS-15 in effect at the end of such calendar year.
Right.
Now, for these people, there were two of those rates during the course of the year.
That's right.
One was 113, no. And one was 130. 128 comes from B. So 128 is out. I'm not talking about 128. I'm talking about under A. The maximum rate of basic pay payable for GS-15, let's just leave aside in effect at the end of the year for a second. Maximum rate of pay, basic pay payable for GS-15 for, oh, I see what you're saying. The maximum rate of basic pay payable for GS-15
is what changed based on their location.
Right, but it still doesn't tell you what this could be doing. Let me put it a different way. What this could be doing is accounting for circumstances in which the maximum rate of basic pay payable for GS-15 goes up or goes down. And it tells you that what you do is you take into account whatever that value is at the very end of the calendar year.
That's how we understand it.
And I mean goes up by statute. So Congress enacts a law that says GS-15 rates are now going to be $5,000 higher than they were before. And then what this statute tells you is, well, you're supposed to look at what the GS-15 rate is by law at the end of the year. It doesn't tell you you don't look at what it is during the course of the year. You look at what it is at the end of the year.
Right, for determining the annual cap for that year. That's right.
But that still doesn't tell you whether locality-based pay is taken into account just based on the locale you're in at the end of the year or based on the locale you're in when you're earning the money.
Well, you'd have to look to other statutes, I suppose, for that. But that's the way that it has been interpreted, and that's the way that it makes sense. Otherwise, you would come into why would you read this any differently than the other statutes that refer to the combination of pay with respect to the locality pay? And so it's that.
I'm not quite following that. So at least that then it sounds like what you're saying is these literal words in 2A can be accommodated to the other side's argument. It's just you have to look elsewhere to understand why that's not the best reading. And maybe that's right.
I don't take this to be an argument that was raised in the brief, so I'm addressing this. But yes, I would think you would need to read the same pari materia with the other pay statutes, and that's where you get it. But it's certainly not either an argument that I understand that they've made or an argument that the statute is silent as to the need to look at year end.
It does sound as the need to look to year end. It definitely tells you to look at
year end. Right, and that's their argument, that there's a silence here about so-called retroactive effect of what they call it. And it's inescapable that you need to look at year end and then look backwards to determine the pay cap. And that's sufficient to defeat their argument, because their argument is that, it doesn't say whether it's retroactive or not. It's inescapable that it's retroactive, regardless of where we come out on the issue you've raised.
I think it's inescapable that you look at the year end.
Yes, that's sufficient to defeat their argument that they make in their papers. That's the point I would lead to.
It would be inescapable that they would lose if what you take into account at year end is where they're located. If that's true, if what governs is where they're located at the end of the year, then yes, they're done.
That's correct.
I'm suggesting is it doesn't tell you that.
But that's not an argument. But the issue as to the sort of prorated based on location, that's an argument they've made. I would put it to the court, you shouldn't consider that at this late point in the case. But if the answer would be in pari materia, I assume. And
when you say in pari materia with what?
Other pay statutes, other way.
Which say, what do they say?
This reference to the pay would include locality pay.
And it would have to lead me to conclude, in order for you to win at step one at least, that you look at the location at the end of the year. And that's definitely a reading of the statute. I'm not saying that's not a good reading of the statute. It's definitely a reading of the statute. What I'm suggesting is it may not be the only plausible reading of the statute.
Perhaps, but it's not one that's been argued through the case, and I would submit that it would be unfair to put me, the government, in the position of having to address it ad hoc like this.
I thought the argument they've been making all along is...
The argument they've been making all along, as I understand it, is that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that there is a silence as to whether this has a retroactive effect. In a sense, I take the argument to mean that the statute needs to use the word retroactive. And that argument is clearly defeated by the fact that you need to look at year-end in order to make the final calculation of the cap. That's sufficient to defeat the argument that they have made.
So it's their use of the word retroactive that leads you to think they're making a particular type of argument, I guess, and you're saying you didn't. Because I think functionally the argument that they're making is the same reading of the statute that I'm suggesting is plausible.
I think you're reading into that. I haven't seen that argument. That strikes me as
new. That's why I said functionally. I'm not focusing on the particular point of whether they spelled it out. All I'm saying is the reading of the statute that I'm suggesting would get them home on the sequence of events that they think is the right way to calculate pay. It's consistent with what they're saying, and your point is...
It creates other problems,
so it's wrong. It's not the argument they've been making, right, because they've been focusing on the word retroactivity, which doesn't tell you how you read the statute.
Yeah, and I would think that, I mean, it kind of flips the whole Chevron regime on its head, because you would need to have had the agency finding this ambiguity and addressing it and filling it in.
Well, I'm not sure which way that cuts, because I think you're supposed to get Chevron deference if you actually identify the ambiguity and explain why you chose one or the other.
Right,
if you don't even think there's an ambiguity in the first place and there is one, well, then that doesn't get Chevron deference.
Their position is that not only should we have identified this as a silence and as an ambiguity, but we should have filled it in this particular way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you get that from a silence. If there is a silence, then we should be able to fill it in, you know, however it is reasonable for us to fill it in on based on an articulation that we would make on remand. But the notion that we must fill it in the particular way that they're suggesting now for the first time today is doubly wrong under Chevron.
Let me ask you this about Chevron. Is this statute one that governs only state employees?
Is it only
DOS employees?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole question.
Is this statute one that governs only the employees of your department?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
So my question then is, do you get Chevron deference at all as to your department's interpretation? The underpinnings of Chevron are that the statute is entrusted to an agency or department of the government, and if there's an ambiguity, Congress must have intended them to resolve it.
Right.
Therefore, we afford deference.
Right.
If this statute is entrusted to OPM or isn't entrusted to anybody in particular,
right,
do you get Chevron deference at state for your interpretation?
Well, as I understand the case law on that, the case law is against that, but we don't rely on Chevron deference in this case, as our papers make absolutely clear. We think the statute operates on plain meaning, and we don't need that.
That's a different question.
It is a different question, yes.
I thought that the Deputy Assistant Secretary relied on OPM, and that OPM is the one, at least in the copy that I have here, is the one that's supposed to prescribe regulations. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Under Section 5547, I haven't had enough chance to completely parse this, but it looks like under B3, subject to regulations prescribed by OPM, and B3C, the Office of Personnel Management shall prescribe regulations governing methods of applying...
547C.
Right.
Okay, there we go.
Office of Personnel Management.
So that if you were to... The question on, I guess, one Chevron question would be whether the reliance on OPM is interpretation of the statute.
But OPM should be the agency getting deference, should it not, rather than state direct.
I think that's right. The only thing we asked for deference for in the brief and in the alternative was the OPM's statement interpreting
I want to make sure I understand correctly where we are.
Yeah, we haven't asked for...
It is OPM that would be getting any deference here. Not.
That's right.
And are you talking about OPM's regulation, or you just said the statement with respect to the regulation?
The statement with respect to the regulation.
So on the statement with respect to the regulation, the statement with respect to the regulation doesn't see any ambiguity. It doesn't purport to do an interpretation. It just right. says this is what the statute says.
All of our position on deference is in the alternative. We don't think we need it, Your Honor. So,
But let's just engage in the alternative for a second. If you do need it, do you get it, given that the statement doesn't purport to be rendering an interpretation as to which the agency was exercising discretion? The agency just says, this is what the statute says. It's the only thing the statute could say. So here's our reg.
And I think it's kind of a moot point because it's not like the agency's interpretation really extends beyond the statute of language. So I would say I would concede the point, but I don't see that it does anything to our case.
As long as you win on the plain meaning of the statute.
Yeah.
Well, I think what Judge Srinivasan is saying, imagine you don't win on the plain meaning. That is, there could be several reasonable...
Of course.
What is your position on... Under those circumstances, do we defer to OPM's view, or do we have to send it back?
To the extent that you find that OPM has articulated a view on and what it means, then yes, you would have to defer to it. But if you find that the OPM statement is not the sort of explanation of what this ambiguity means, then you would send it back.
And what's your position on that?
I can't speak for how the agency would fill it in. I don't understand your question.
You're asking us to defer to something. As I read your brief, you're asking us to defer to something.
To the extent that you find that there is any ambiguity, I would think that you could be guided by the statement of the OPM. That's the only point we're making. It's a small point.
Meaning that? Are you saying that?
Chevron standard, yes.
And I guess my question about that is, don't we usually only extend deference like that in a situation in which the agency is exercising discretion? And if it's not exercising any discretion, then it's not the type of thing to which a court would typically defer to an agency.
I concede the point. But it's immaterial here, I maintain.
Wait, are you conceding that the agency did not OPM did not exercise any discretion in its interpretation of the statute?
No, Your Honor. The agency... So
what is it that you are conceding?
Which step of Chevron are you at?
We are at Chevron 1, Your Honor.
Oh, I'm asking...
We're talking about Chevron 2. Sorry.
Okay. That's what I'm first trying to find out. Your position in the first instance is this is plain meaning.
Yes.
And we don't need difference.
That's right.
But then if we disagree with you on that and we're in Chevron 2 land, I guess this is then correct. The question becomes, is there an occasion for conferring discretion in the way we normally would? I get that you can see the legal point that if the agency didn't exercise discretion, then we wouldn't defer. My question is the factual one. Is this a situation in which we should defer? What are we deferring to?
You'd be deferring to the regulation and its articulation of the five factors that are more specific than what the statute laid out in terms of how to make a showing.
I'm not talking about waiver. We're talking about the first question about how you construe 5547. And on that, I thought the government's position was that we defer, if you get past step one, we defer to OPM's determination that the best way to read this statute is that you take into account where the person happens to be situated at the very end of the year.
But
yes, is that the argument that you're making?
It is now. I mean, as I understand the issue of the supposed ambiguity being taking in the yes. location, which I take to be a new argument that I would urge the court not to reach. But.
No, I guess I'm sorry to belabor this, but you just indulge me in the fanciful universe in which we don't agree with you at Chevron step one. Let's just assume that you don't get all the way home on that, just for argument purposes. What are we deferring to? What's the document? There's something that usually we would defer to.
The statement is the only thing we have put forward, Your Honor.
And that statement, where does that statement manifest the exercise of discretion to which we would refer? To which we would defer. That's in the Federal Register?
Yeah, the statement that I quoted on my brief on page 22 refers to a geographic move in an area with different pay rates can raise or lower an employee's aggregate basic pay and end-of-year annual cap on premium pay. The language is set forth there. That would be what we would ask you to defer to.
In the Federal Register. But I guess my question is, are you reading from the Federal Register? I just want to make sure we're looking at the same thing.
That's how I quoted in the brief, yes.
It's in the Federal Register.
Right.
And I guess my question is, if OPM thought that it didn't have any discretion on that, that it just thought that, well, of course this is right, because this is what the statute, this is the only plausible way to read the statute. If that's what OPM says, then is there anything to defer to? Because they're not exercising any discretion. They're just saying this reading is compelled by the statute.
Then I think it would depend on the nature of the ambiguity that the court would be the first one to identify in order to know whether this would be something that you could defer to or not. Because it's kind of putting up, I don't know what the problem that
you identify. In other words, it would have to be ambiguous on the very point at question.
Yeah.
Well, suppose we think it is. Suppose we think it is ambiguous. I'm not saying we do, but suppose we think it is ambiguous as to the very point in question.
Well, then the agencies can, I think the agency statement here fills that in, because it's implicitly clear from your reasoning that this is not a point that's addressed in the statute.
No, but what if the agency, I'm not seeing the language in this, what the agency says that tells me that they're exercising the discretion. Suppose the agency says this: here's the issue that's being raised by a commenter. This issue is a non-issue because the statute answers the question. It tells you what the answer is. The answer is X, and which is exactly what you quoted to me. At that point, are we deferring to – is there anything to defer to? I think the answer is no.
I think it's a bit of a tripwire to say if the agency thinks that this issue that had not been identified to it, their broad statement, we don't need deference, means no way you're going to get deference on ancillary points that may have been filled in by statements like this that it would in fact fill an ambiguity that is identified after the fact. It seems kind of just an exercise in process over substance to send it back for the agency to say, okay,
it is the Administrative Procedure Act.
We do want deference, and we're going to repeat the same sentence, that a geographic move to an area with different pay differential. That doesn't seem to make sense to me. If there are no further questions, we would urge the court to affirm.
So, there are time? I'll tell you what, we have some questions for you, so why don't you come up and you can, instead of having your own time, you'll have our time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, I have a question for you. I'm still having a little trouble understanding exactly what your interpretation of the statute is and how it actually plays out in a given circumstance. So, as I understood we were talking before, let's assume they worked 6 months under the higher cap and 6 months under the lower. Your view is that as long as they didn't make more than $125,000 aggregate in the first half, they can keep all of their, I mean, not $130,000. They can keep whatever they made.
Prorated for that part of the year. Yes, sir.
Oh, no. Well,
in other words, they wouldn't be over. They wouldn't have made more than $130,000.
Yes, as long as it, but it's not prorated. It's not like you take half of $130,000. You say as long as the aggregate at the end of the 6 months is not greater than $130,000, they can keep whatever they have.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Not prorated.
It's not prorated, right? Let's put a number on it. Let's say they made $125,000 as of the end of the 6 months. Okay? Total, aggregate, everything. Locality pay, premium pay, everything. Okay? Imagine that they did. They made $125,000 in just 6 months because they did a lot, huge amount of overtime. Okay?
I understand.
Right. Your view is since $125,000 is less than $130,000, they can keep the whole $125,000. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, for the second half, for that, you agree that the cap would be $128,000?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And does that start over again? So as long as they make less than $128,000 in the second half, they can keep whatever they make?
I have to say I don't know how that would work in terms of an employee who would be paid more than the cap salary for the year. In other words, all of all of these folks have a ranking. They have different rankings, but they all have different GS rankings.
Yeah.
And so it's the limitation on premium pay is based solely on two elements of their pay, meaning basic pay and premium pay. I don't know how we would.
So under your theory, you don't know what to do with the second half. Is that what you're saying?
It's a little bit soft as I think it
right.
through.
Because if they make this is not your folks, I understand. But if you make $125,000 aggregate for everything in the first half of the year, you let them keep all of that, right? Because it's under $130,000, right? And if they then make $125,000 in just 6 months because of a huge amount of overtime in the second 6 months, they get to keep all of that also because that's less than $128,000.
Judge, that sounds right. I'm not sure how it would work in terms of government accounting. It sounds intuitively right to me.
It may sound right, but then that means that somebody could earn $250,000.
That's
why I'm asking you what if we have to choose whose interpretation is better, the government's or yours. You and you think the government's is absurd. You have an absurdity problem too.
And I think, and this is thinking on my feet, I think perhaps the real answer is going back to the memo from AFSA, which is compute the overtime. And that's why I hesitated as much as I like your construct, mm-hmm. Runner, is compute the overtime for each segment of the year. Now, I don't know if that means prorated or not, Judge Sentel, because it's already beyond my mathematical expertise.
I'm not quite understanding this, because I thought, first of all, we're only talking about a cap as to premium pay.
Correct.
Of course you get to keep all the basic pay you make in the last 6 months of the year, no matter what, because that's not capped.
Well, it's a raw number, so when they're giving money back, they're giving money back. Their basic pay is capped by their rank.
But the statute doesn't tell you that you can't make any more than X amount in basic pay.
But the GS ranking does.
That may be true.
So that's why I hesitate.
That's not what the question was about.
But in terms of pure overtime, perhaps the middle ground might be, and again, this hasn't been fleshed out in the administrative proceedings, is the AFSA memo, which is I'm being paid from January to June as if I have a $130,000 cap. Then I'm paid from July to December. As if I have a $128,000
premium pay. Yeah.
Right. And there's mathematically a way to work that out in terms of a number because there's a formula in the regs for computing out overtime in advance, which is one of the things I was talking about earlier. I don't think it's a new argument. I went back and looked at pages 28 through 30 of my brief. It's the same argument we've been making all along. The brief is replete with all of the promises of computing out ahead of time, and the regulations adopted in September 2004 create the mechanism for withholding premium pay. So
what does the statute dictate under, as we at least seemed clear before that your view was you could earn $125,000 of premium pay, or you could earn, $129,000 of premium pay in the first half of the year and not be over the cap, and you get to keep it.
Judge, I don't think that I ever articulated that position.
Well, what if this happened? What if they did earn $129,000 in premium pay? They worked every night, every weekend, battle zone, whatever goes to premium, they made that much. But it's still under the cap. And then they never worked again the rest of the year overtime. They would certainly be allowed to keep it then, right?
You're talking about $125,000 in overtime?
Imagine an ordinary circumstance where the $130,000 cap applies for the whole year. They're on TDY the whole year, right? If in the first 6 months they earned $129,000 of overtime and they never earned another nickel, they would be able to keep it. There wouldn't be any dispute about that, right?
$129,000 in overtime plus their basic pay would exceed the cap.
But I thought
the cap is a combination of basic pay and premium. It's a combination of basic pay and premium that can't exceed the cap.
But the only thing that can't exceed it is premium pay.
No, the total cannot. The aggregate, that's what the statute says. The aggregate cannot exceed
You can't keep your premium pay if the aggregate exceeds a particular number. That's all we're talking about.
You're never going to have to kick back far enough to cut into your base fee.
All we're talking about is whether you get to keep premium.
All the cut's going to be in premium.
Because that's on the back end.
Right. But if the aggregate is $129,000, and that obviously has to, in 6 months, that obviously has to include a lot of premium pay, right?
If someone earned $129,000 in the first 6 months,
would they be able to keep the premium pay?
I don't know that they could keep the premium pay because they were still going to get basic pay for the rest of the year.
I see.
And it's the combination of basic and premium that sets the cap.
Yeah.
That's the problem. If you look at it,
they have to kick back at least part of their premium then, no matter how.
Exactly. So I'm not sure that construct works either. It's an awkward fit, and
your construction of the statute would seem to put it in a position where it's difficult to figure out that they would have to get that back.
So the only one that I think would work, as awkward as it is the APSA suggestion for just calculate it out when they change the pay cap, if you will, and compute ahead, as they now say they can, but they couldn't then, and how much premium pay could be earned. Because the government can't accept volunteer workers.
I don't really necessarily think you're putting a proper reliance on that principle. The government cannot accept volunteer work. That doesn't really come into play.
Well,
these people are being paid. The only question is whether they're being paid enough to meet what they're supposed to
be. And they did volunteer work.
The rule against volunteerism does not seem to me to have applicability. You do argue it, but I stop and think about our situation.
I understand.
I want to get the same thing whether I'm sitting here today or not.
I understand, Your Honor.
I can do this. The rule against volunteerism doesn't keep me from doing this. And I don't think it keeps them from working overtime.
Not at all. And my guys work countless hours.
I don't think that principle has anything to do with
it. I was arguing it in terms of how you construe a statute. Do you construe a statute to mean that you can compel unpaid work as opposed to accept unpaid work by a paid government employee? And I see a huge difference between the two things. If an employee knew in June, as Mr. Bopp would have known had they told him that you can't get paid any more overtime. I guarantee you, knowing Mr. Bopp, he would have worked just as hard. But there's a big difference between working hard, doing your job, protecting the embassy,
the notice point we were making earlier,
and paying back salary that you paid, and I hope reasonably presumed to have spent in the ordinary course of life for someone making about $130,000 a year.
I'm sorry. I just go back to Chief Judge Garland's hypothetical. So at a point in time of the year in which you're treated as being located in D.C., so the cap, if nothing else changed, would be 130, and you haven't yet made 130, you've made 129, you're saying under your own argument you don't know whether you get to keep all 129?
Because your cap is 130 for the year, a combination of basic and premium, and you have to be paid your basic pay. Which is exactly why, Your Honor, the State Department kept telling my clients, we will, and telling everybody, it's in the OPM memo, we can calculate out ahead.
I'm not following is, I'm obviously missing something basic, but at this point in time, you've made 129. You have a 130 cap for the year, but you haven't reached it yet. So why don't you get to keep the 129? Why don't you know under your argument that you get to keep the 129? And the only question is whether you're going to be able to keep premium pay that you may earn in the future.
Because if you, again, go back to my unfortunately miscited statement to Mr. Bopp's pay records, his total pay for the year was about $138,000. And the cap was $128,000 applied backwards to the whole year. So he was ordered to pay back about $5,700. So if they had two different caps, you would calculate the first year, first half of the year based on the higher cap, and the second half of the year based on the lower cap. And no, that would not get him all the way home. We would have to prevail on the retroactive waiver or by the government or our waiver argument. But he would then have some chunk of change that he wouldn't have to pay back to the government. That's basically what our argument is. Is that you have to come up with some mechanism for doing that, and they can do that now. They have a mechanism for doing it at the front door, and to do it again when it changed. They said they had a mechanism in place in 2004, and they didn't. which is why we only found out in November. I thank the court for its indulgence and for its time. Thank you.
The matter under submission. Thank you.